Extreme cold weather advisory in effect this morning.
You're a contractor. You have a contract.
All right, guys, come on. Let's do this.
A little snow and ice isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all, too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I'm Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I am joined today by Allison Makor, the author of Rewrite Man, the life and career of screenwriter Warren Scarron, an author in Austin, Texas. I'm very excited to talk to her today because I recently read her book. This came out in 2017, 2018. I read it this week, and it's really pretty fascinating. I could introduce Warren Scarron, but I think you, as the actual biographer, would be better qualified to do that. Who was Warren Scarron, and why are we talking about? Well, I'll get to the why we're talking about him. But who is Warren Scarron? Tell the people who Warren Scarron was.
Warren Scarron was a screenwriter, and he it was the writer for the last writer for Top Gun, Beetlejuice, Beverly Hills Cop 2, and Batman. He started his career as a script doctor in Hollywood, but before that, he was the first head of the Texas Film Commission. So he kind of segued out of politics into film and then into Hollywood. And it looked as if he was an overnight sensation because one of his first credits was Top Gun. But honestly, he had been building toward that for about 10 years, which, you know, I think is typical of a lot of writers, right, who are overnight successes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because there's an interesting side of this that I think a lot of people don't either know about or really appreciate with screenwriting, right, which is that especially in kind of modern Hollywood, but even back in the golden age of the studios, these movies aren't always written by one person. It's not one person sitting down at a typewriter and banging it out. There are often teams of writers, and there are people who go through and rewrite work and try and punch up stuff and all that. And the case of Scarron is very interesting because he became kind of well, I don't know if he was a poster child for the problems with the various arbitration issues, but the WGA arbitration and the system of arbitration used by the Academy was not to his benefit, at least at first. So could you talk a little bit about his problems there with Top Gun and I don't know how that got resolved and what he would do in the future to kind of make it better for him?
Sure. I mean, Top Gun, as I said, it wasn't his first. He had done something called Fire with Fire, and that brought him to the attention of Don Steele at Paramount. And so when Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer were having problems with Top Gun, she said to them, "Hey, guys, I've just worked with this writer in Austin. Name's Warren Scarron. You might want to meet with him." And they did. And the cool thing is, you know, all of Scarron's files are in an archive here, a well-known one in Austin called the Harry Ransom Center. And he recorded a lot of his phone conversations because I think in part he was working from Austin. There might have been a little bit of paranoia there too. And in Texas, you know, there you don't have to let the other person know you're recording them, which is kind of interesting. So there's even a recording in his file with the credits administrator at the WGA that I listened to that was really helpful and sort of just reinforced how kind of arbitrary, for lack of a better word, the process is. On Top Gun, you know, he and Simpson, really, they clicked pretty quickly. And Scarron was really eager. He knew this was a big deal. Tom Cruise was about to leave the project. So he turned something in about maybe a third to a half the time that maybe a regular writer would do. I think he turned his first outline around in 10 days. And really Cruise was about to leave the project because he didn't like the character. He thought Maverick was, to use his words, an asshole. And so one of Scarron's biggest jobs on this was to make him more relatable, more accessible. Mm-hmm. And Cruise, you know, had just done Risky Business. So his star was definitely on the rise. So there were things that he was considering, you know, my star going to look like, you know, who am I as an actor? And this would change for him. And that would kind of come back around for Warren too, working on Days of Thunder. But so for Top Gun, Warren really just kind of sat down, had to figure out how to make Cruise more relatable. I mean, one of the key things he did too was one of the previous writers had done the character of Carol, who was Goose's wife. And she was just really just the wife. But Scarron wrote this scene after Goose's death that put Carol, that sort of showed a more sympathetic side of Maverick. It had the two of them interact. It was an emotional scene. And it was things like that he was able to do. You know, and I can, maybe some people who aren't fans of the movie may be rolling their eyes like, you know, I'm sorry, motion in Top Gun. But I mean, it was the kind of thing that he brought to it. How can we make this maybe a movie that not just guys would go see, but maybe guys and their girlfriends at that time in, what was it, 85, 86 Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that you emphasize in this is that he kind of really punched up the female characters. Also Kelly Preston's Charlie gets a much bigger, meatier role here.
Yeah.
And so he goes through all this. There's a great passage in your book, and I actually took a photo of it. I want to read from it right here. The experience of writing it. So he wrote this. He basically did a page one rewrite in what, 2 weeks, three weeks, something like that. And you know, that is a very fast turnaround on a script like this. I will just put it that way. But there's this amazing passage in your book about what this did to him physically. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting from your book now. Still, the experience had taken a toll. Toward the end, Scarron was wearing a patch over his left eye to compensate for the sudden inability to focus. His hands, which had become calloused from round-the-clock typing, were bandaged in bubble wrap. I mean, that was that like it's an actual physical thing. And then so he bangs out this first draft. He goes to the set. He's actually there doing, you know, on-set rewrites and helping with dialogue and running the actors through dialogue and all that. He's on calls with Tony Scott and Tom Cruise. And then he doesn't get a credit. Mm-hmm. In the movie. I mean, mm-hmm. This is the thing that is so fascinating to me. It's clear that he is an integral part of the film, but he wasn't the first writer. And right. People who aren't the first writer often get kind of screwed in these arbitrations. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that process was like and what it did to him?
Yeah, the Writers Guild, the manual, is sort of predisposed to give the first writer credit if possible. And in some ways that was a protective measure, right? To protect them from producers coming in, producers' girlfriends, producers' boyfriends, you know, whatever. And if you look at the, when a studio sends in the list of materials to start the credit process, it's basically a one or two sheet that lists every single source material. So for Top Gun, for instance, it started with this article in, I believe it was California Magazine, about Top Guns, you know, about these elite fighters. And then the last 10, and I think the list, it's been a little while, but I think the list was maybe 20 things. And the last 10 things were all Scarron's work, and he didn't get the credit. When it goes to the credit process and somebody disputes it, a writer disputes what's proposed. And in this case, it was Cash and Epps, the team who had written the original screenplay, the first one. And they were a writing team. They worked together out of one in LA, one in Michigan. Scarron disputed that. And so everybody has to basically write a statement of arbitration, a statement of contribution that says, here's what I did, essentially. And Scarron's was very, you know, direct. It was passionate. But it, you know, didn't change anybody's mind. Now, to me, the interesting thing about that situation is that, you know, I think he was held in such high esteem by people like Don Steele at Paramount that he was given an associate producer's credit. And it was sort of back engineered. So he got this one memo that said, okay, so here's what you will also be doing. You know, you'll be going to these test screenings, you'll be doing sitting in on these, you know, editing sessions. It was just all this other stuff he had to do in addition to kind of getting the movie onto the screen. And, you know, he was upset. And I love what his agent, Mike Simpson, who is, you know, still, he's like a VP at William Morris today. He's Quentin Tarantino's agent. He's a lot of Tim Burton, you know, there's a lot of connections here to Austin too. Mike Simpson was in Austin for a time. But he said something to him along the lines of, you know, we're like samurais or warriors, you know, we kind of, it was a very Zen thing to say, sort of like, take this in, learn from it, and go forward. And by the way, everybody in this town knows that you wrote this movie. And that's essentially how it works. You know, people are aware of who does what. And so, you know, it didn't mean he didn't get work again. It just meant that he got an associate producer's credit. And it's funny, I was just looking at the credits on IMDb, and I don't know when this happened, but he is listed on there as uncredited screenwriter. I don't know when that was added, who put that in, I don't know. Yeah. I want to say it wasn't there when I was working on the book, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. There are always all of these great stories about uncredited writers, you know, doing punch up work, right? Like Quentin Tarantino, you mentioned, right, is often credited with punching up Crimson Tide and all sorts of movies with little great speeches and bits of dialogue. John Milius's, you know, Jaws speech, right? I mean, there's all sorts of great stories like that. So Scarron, he doesn't get the credit here. He does end up getting more money because he gets profit participation,
right?
Which is kind of an interesting little tidbit from your book. But
his checks are still rolling in a very strange twist. It's a long story, but I am now on the board of the trust that was set up. And so I know very well what's coming in. Hmm. And
those are still coming into the family trust or whatever. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a charitable trust, I should add. So, yeah.
Okay. Oh, very, that is very interesting. But you know, there's another passage from your book that I want to read here because it gets kind of to the heart of this whole question and this whole conversation that I want to have, which is when he signs with William Morris, you know, he kind of writes a memo or a letter, to himself or to someone, but it basically, the big question he asks in this memo is, who owns a screenplay which I write for someone else? And that to me is the kind of, again, the heart of the matter here, the real crux of the issue, which is, you know, a writer writes and a writer feels like he owns the thing that he writes. But when you're working for these kind of massive conglomerations of studios and corporate interests and whatever, there, that's a real question. And it's real tricky to untangle. Do you think that the process that they have in place for this, or at least the process that they had in place for this then, is a useful or fair one for getting the writers the credit they deserve?
You know, I quote from an attorney who, you know, wrote this legal kind of brief or article about this process. And he came down on the side of, it's not a great process, but it's probably the best one for this business, which has to get movies out by a certain time, with a lot of money being on the line. And so I guess that's kind of where I come down. One of the things that surprised me is that by the time I was finishing this book, I went and, you know, was looking at the screenwriter's manual or the Writers Guild manual. And I just couldn't believe how little had changed, that there haven't been major revisions, especially given now how many platforms are in use, you know, and how that might affect a writer's contribution and at what stage. So it is like turning a cruise liner, you know, I think, to get any of these changes made. And it's you know, it's a system that's been in place for a while. And I think there's probably so many workarounds, like things like give them an associate producer's credit or so-and-so knows what he's done. You know, to be honest, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is, you know, I taught for a long time and taught film history classes. And I was kind of surprised that never in the curriculum or very rarely in the curriculum for the production students, were there any like sort of real classes about script doctoring. I mean, I know it was talked about, but since it's going to be the reality for so many people, especially new writers coming out of, you know, writing programs, I just thought, this is going to be the reality. Somebody needs to write about this. And then I discovered his archive and was like, whoa, this is like an interesting, tragic story built around this whole idea of authorship.
Yeah, we'll get to the tragedy in a moment. It is he died young. We'll talk about that in a bit. But then, okay, so Top Gun happens. He doesn't quite get the credit he probably deserves. And then the next couple of films are Beverly Hills Cop 2, which there's a whole nother lawsuits and you know and all that. But before that, around the same time, there's Beetlejuice, right? And Beetlejuice is interesting because in your book you emphasize that he was in touch with the original writer and was like, hey, let's not fight about this. Mm-hmm. Let's all, you know, kind of work together so we don't go through this process again. And I was curious, you know, what your sense was of how the original author of Beetlejuice acclimated to that, and if that was a better way of doing it.
Well, you know, within the Writers Guild's rules, there is a rule that says writers can resolve credit issues or disputes among themselves. So that is an option. And I think Skarin was very much like, this is not happening to me again, what happened on Top Gun. And he was a people person for sure. And so he's like, I'm going to reach out from the beginning and try to smooth this over. I don't have McDowell's sort of side of it. And he died, you know, before I wrote the book a little before I wrote the book. But I can tell you that from the way the credit worked out on that film, that it was a much better situation than it had happened on Top Gun. And I think that's because, you know, Warren understood, I want to, you know, reach out. I want to tell this person, okay, I'm working with your script. You know, he was trying to make it as transparent as possible in what is essentially a very, you know, opaque, a very non-transparent process.
Yeah. And then, of course, Beverly Hills Cop 2 is, as I said, kind of a whole different thing with involving lawsuits that had been sparked by something that Gore Vidal had started years before. Could you walk us through the whole rigmarole there? That's a real can of worms.
It is a can of worms. I'm not sure 3 years down I can really every nuance, but I will do my best. So
broad strokes are fine. We're dealing with broad strokes here.
You know, they were having problems with Beverly Hills Cop 2 and they called Warren. And yeah, I think he was working on Beetlejuice and this may have even carried over to when he was working on Batman. I'm not sure this was a very short period of time, like 4 or 5 years that Warren did all these films. And so the Beverly Hills Cop 2 is a sequel. And so you're working with, you know, story credit, original characters created by, I think it's Daniel Petrie, and there was another writer. The thing that's so hilarious about Cop 2 is that two Austin writers were actually among the first writers, or one Austin, one Dallas, Bud Schrake and Dan Jenkins. And Bud and Warren were friends, and yet they had no idea until the very final credit thing that they had all worked on this same thing. Mm. You know, and literally Bud and Warren lived maybe 2 miles away from each other. And so Bud Schrake and Dan Jenkins did a first pass. I think they had some kind of, you know, a caper set in a warehouse. It might have involved illegal arms. I'm not sure, terrorists. I don't quite remember. Then the idea came about to sort of make this about like a series of murders based on the alphabet. Now, here's where it gets really kind of not confusing, but tricky, because it only came up at the end during the arbitration that Eddie Murphy and his manager, Robert I think you say WACH, W-A-C-H. They had sort of, they put in for story credit because they claimed that it was their idea. But this was sort of at the back end. And so, you know, Warren fought that, by the way. Because to him, it seemed like maybe the paper that was signed that, yes, we hereby say we came up with this idea, sort of looked like it might have been signed a year or two later. So they came up supposedly with this story idea. Then a guy named Larry Ferguson was brought in to write, to do a screenplay. And, you know, I read all these screenplays. I would sit down and read them in order so I could get a sense of what was changing, who did what. It was a painful process, I must say.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, since you bring it up here, I'll just ask here. I haven't had a chance to like scour through the sources yet of your book, but it is interesting to me that, you know, you're talking about like minute changes that kind of accumulate into larger changes as it goes. I mean, in theory, this is what the arbitrator should be doing, right? Is looking at each of these script drafts and saying like, okay, this is this, and we finally get from point A to point Z. But you know, what's your interpretation of kind of like reading them one after the other? Is it just mind numbing? Do you just kind of like start to blink out after a little while? And because that is, if I had to do this, I know I would, you know, I'd be getting kind of bleary eyed by the end.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, I had two fellowships to write this book, which means like I went to the archive like for a month at a time, each time was able, which was a gift, you know, to work on this project and go through the files. I remember very distinctly, like it took me maybe 2 or 3 days, 8-hour days of going through the Top Gun materials. And my husband said later that he felt like I was more aggressive that week. Like I just seemed like more angry and aggressive after I got through all the Top Gun stuff, which, you know, it's kind of hilarious. but yeah, it can be mind numbing. It can be hard to figure out, well, what's changing here? In the case of the Ferguson screenplay for Beverly Hills Cop 2, while you might have had a decent structure, I can tell you, especially as a woman, reading his female characters, I was like, what the what? Because, like, I think he used the word gazongas or something to describe one of the characters' breasts. And I thought, oh my God. And, you know, Scarron read it too. And he had written in the margin something like, you know, no female characters in this movie, no softness. And so, I mean, those are the kinds of things he was charged with, not just beefing up the structure, making it, have it make more sense, and not just, you know, improving the male characters, but also, like, for instance, on Beverly Hills Cop 2, he brought in this character of Jan, who was the detective's daughter. He kind of created this character, and she could kind of be a surrogate for the detective when he was recovering from an injury, you know, during the film. So it was an interesting way to do it. And there was one point I remember in the back and forth of the memos where, she was becoming a really interesting character. I mean, I was reading her on the page and thinking, oh, this is really interesting. And I forget who, but somebody said, you know what, she's becoming almost too interesting. You know, she's got too much agency. We need to change this. I mean, that was essentially what they were saying. So it was fascinating to read stuff like that. You know, you really see sort of the power dynamics and you understand, oh, this star is going to play this person, and not only a star, but a male star. And so this character cannot, you know, be too interesting. But anyway, so Scarron, you know, did all this work on the script, and then there might have been somebody who came in. I think, Dennis Klein, somebody named Dennis Klein had come in. Not somebody, he was a TV writer. He had punched up the comedy before Scarron got to the script. And he was able to get Axel Foley to Beverly Hills sooner. But again, Warren came in and sort of, he shaped it in a very specific way. He was really good at establishing relationships among the characters or strengthening them. And he did that with Bogomil and Axel, you know, and in part through having them, I think, talking in the very beginning of the film about going on a fishing trip. You know, it was just stuff like that that he could throw in. I mean, he's really good at observing people, understanding what made relationships personal, and kind of sprinkling that stuff through a screenplay.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think about how that kind of works into the arbitration system, because I know that one of the things that they look at, it's hard to measure, you know, characterization, right? It's hard to say you've provided 50% of this character's development or whatever. But the things that they can look at are things like structure and things like new characters and new locations. Could you break that down a little bit for us? Because again, I don't think people understand exactly how that works, how that actually, you know, makes sense to the arbitrators.
Well, and the arbitrators are very wary of things like new characters, right? Because if you're a writer coming on a script and you understand that, okay, I've got to make, you know, maybe if you're a writer who's been through this process, you may think, oh, well, I could, you know, invent some characters, and that may make it look as if I did more than, you know, added to this thing. So I think they're very wary of stuff like that. I not to demonize the arbitrators, you know, who are anonymous. I mean, I think it would be difficult in some ways. I mean, you could easily say, yeah, but Eddie Murphy is known for improvisation and he came into this. So who's to say, you know, how much he imprinted, you know, brought back Axel. Do you know what I'm saying? So they lead with the character thing. How much credit do you give to somebody like Warren? I mean, I think factoring all that in, it's not just dialogue and all of that. It is, you also have to consider, you know, star power and presence. But as far as walking you through it, I mean, it's a secretive, anonymous process, the arbitrators going through the materials, and it's they just sort of go through it and then they make their suggestions, and then the writers get a letter saying the credits will remain as is or the credits will change. Mm-hmm. And Ferguson was disputing the fact that he and Scarron were sharing credit on this mm-hmm. film. He thought that he had done, you know, enough work to get a solo credit. And as you know, from reading the book, he disputed this for years. And so, you know, which meant that Warren was caught up in these lawsuits that carried out, honestly, you know, they ended only after his death, really.
Right. Right. Again, we'll get there shortly, very unfortunately shortly. After Beverly Hills Cop 2, there is his biggest hit, his biggest payday, etc. Batman, which was, again, it reminded me a little bit of the Top Gun situation where he comes in and I don't think there's not the same sort of credit dispute, but in terms of like kind of almost doing a page one rewrite. And then being on set and working with the stars, working with Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton, and first Sean Young and then Kim Basinger after Sean Young left the production. What was that whole experience like? Because there is an argument to be made that Batman changed Hollywood in as much as any movie since maybe Star Wars, in terms of its size and the materials it was working with and that sort of thing. I mean, what was that like for him as a rewrite man, but also just as an artist and as a you know, filmmaker?
Well, he was very valuable, you know, by this point in Hollywood, and so he had a piece of Batman, which was tremendous, really, when you think of what that movie did. And he flew to London. He was working on, you know, during this time, he was working on things that never saw the light of day, which is very typical, but he's working with big people like Michael Douglas. You know, he's going to Hong Kong and he's trying to write the third in the Romancing the Stone series. So he wasn't, with Batman, it was sort of more of the same. You know, there were problems with the script, but there were problems with the Bruce Wayne character. And, you know, this is Bruce Wayne, and this is a comic book character. So he also had to deal with Bob Kane.
Bob Kane, sure. Yes. Yeah.
And that, you know, he got this sort of withering letter from him in the beginning, just saying, like, these are my characters and, you know, just want you to know that I'm, you know, I'm a consultant and I'm important. Yeah. So there was sort of even more stuff to deal with on Batman. And then, you know, Sean Young getting injured and having to be replaced. Kim Basinger comes on, and then there's like weirdness behind the scenes where she's having a relationship with one of the producers, and Warren gets pulled in to kind of counsel. I mean, what the what? And again, yeah, that's a tribute to Warren's interpersonal skills. But yeah, he on Batman, he was right there on set, and there's a picture in the book that Sean Young took of everybody working at this long table. And it was that intense. He was working with Michael Keaton. He was working a lot, you know, Jack Nicholson, he was a tough nut to crack, but they finally kind of, I don't know if I'd say bonded, but they, you know, they had a meeting of the minds over Nietzsche. So he put a little bit of that into, you know, the Joker character. And again, that's one of those things where this didn't go to arbitration, but if you're going to, you know, go into that, you're going to think, okay, there's this on the page, but there's also Jack Nicholson, you know, and Jack Nicholson, the Joker, I think a lot of people associate him with the Joker, you know? So another complicated production, and one that was very, that was hugely successful for him.
Yeah. Yeah. As we've suggested a couple of times here, he died shortly after that movie was released. I mean, we're not less than a year, I think, right? I forget what the exact timeline was, but, around a year, yes, or something like that. It was in 1990, end of 1990. Yeah. So, yeah. But like, that's a little bit tragic and unfortunate. Could you just talk a little bit about the end of the illness and just to give people a sense what we've been hinting at?
He had a cancer diagnosis around 1987 that he kept secret from his pretty much, you know, those closest to him, except for maybe his wife and a couple other people. He was advised to do some treatments beyond, you know, removal beyond surgery, and he chose not to. And so 2 years, actually 3 years later, you know, it really like literally took him down. He was in so much pain. He had so much back pain. He went in, he was looked at here locally in Austin, and then was sort of told, you need to get to MD Anderson in Houston, like, ASAP, and he was there within a day or two, and then was basically given, you know, he was given 6 months to live. And, you know, he was still trying to work on the sequel to Beetlejuice at that time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it just, his life took on this kind of other worldly quality, in part because he wanted to try to treat the cancer with alternative methods that, you know, now may have had very different outcomes, but at the time, you know, and so he sort of brought in this team around him of people who were, you know, cooking macrobiotic meals, and he was a healthy person, and so it wasn't completely, you know, different for him. But sort of he put all his energy, what little energy he had left, into this, going this route.
Yeah.
There were
It's just kind of a bummer to read, because you read this book, you kind of get to know him, and he seems like, you know, kind of a fun, almost domineering type at times in terms of taking charge and all that. But you know, what's interesting, and I had no idea. I mean, I live in Dallas now. I've lived here for 10 months a year or so. I had no idea that A, You know, he had lived here in Austin, but also B was involved with the formation of the Texas Film Commission and was kind of a silent partner on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which he was a producer's rep,
what we would call a producer's rep today. And he actually helped get the deal for Chainsaw to be distributed by this small independent company named Bryanston, who also had mob ties. Now, I grew up in New Jersey, so, you know, like when people are like, that sounds made up, I'm like, it is not. And they had set up Bryanston as kind of a front, you know, I mean, just as Hollywood was diversifying around this time, so was the mob. And so Bryanston had done, forgetting the name of the Linda Lovelace film,
Deep Throat.
And that film, you know, was brought up on obscenity charges. And so the company ended up going under because of that and other reasons. And in some ways sort of bringing down Chainsaw's earnings with it. Although that film continues to send in checks to.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. So I mean that was pretty much everything I wanted to talk about. I think it's a really interesting story and a really interesting book. People should check it out. It's called Rewrite Man, The Life and Career of Screenwriter Warren Skaron. Is there anything else that you think people should know about Warren or about any of the stuff we've discussed today? I always like to ask my guests if there's something I should have asked, if there's something that you think that people should know about the topic.
I think it just, you know, Warren's story interested me because it really represented a specific time and place in Hollywood and gave a great example of a subject that, as you said, people, the average moviegoer, knows very little about. It's a very complicated subject, and it's still very relevant to movie making in our time. And so that's why I wanted to write about it. You know, I think Warren's story is dramatic and tragic, and it also shows, you know, how one script doctor kind of made his way, at least for a time, in Hollywood. And I appreciate your interest in it. You know, it's oddly enough, maybe not oddly enough, but there has been screenwriting interest or screenplay interest in this book. And so I just think Warren would think that was hilarious given, you know, all that's gone on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great. Thank you very much for joining me, Allison. I really appreciate it. I think this is a fun chat. And like I said, the book's on Amazon. I picked it up here in town at a bookstore, but it's on Amazon, so everybody can check it out if they want. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood.